an Ironic Media production. Visit us at ironicmedia.com.
What I guess I didn't realize was how much slower he would get. And I'm not talking about the brain, movements. I know that we would go in for checkups, and I know that the doctor would have him do squats and test all kinds of things that a geriatric doctor does test. And then she would laugh and say, "All right, Eric, you're fine. You can stop doing those now." And more recently, watching his balance, or he has what the doctor has termed a startle effect. So it's the startling effect that infants and newborns get, right? Of just a nerve reaction in their body where there's a jolt. And he gets them now. And he sometimes is literally thrown off of his feet. And there's no explanation for it, except to say that it's the nerves in his body reacting to the disease. And he has a lot of trembling. Those are the really challenging things, because you still have somebody who's mobile.
Dementia Discussions. Here to help and empower our heroic caregivers with knowledge and experience. Dementia Discussions with the caregivers themselves and memory loss professionals. Here to help with 30 years as a geriatric social worker is your Dementia Discussions host, Barbara Hammond.
Hello and welcome to Dementia Discussions. I'm Barbara Hammond. Today on the show, I have a great guest. And before I get to her, I would encourage anyone listening, if you have a story that you'd like to tell on Dementia Discussions, I would love to chat with you. Please call me at 310-362-8232. And just know that you would be helping your fellow caregiver. And with that, I would like to welcome my guest, Kimberly Cruel.
Hi there.
Good morning. It's so great to meet you.
So great to meet you.
This is the first time we're meeting. Kimberly attends a support group that she'll talk about in a bit. You're here to talk about your husband. So tell us your story.
So my husband is 55. He'll be 56 in April. And it's been about 6 years now since he was diagnosed with young onset Alzheimer's. But we had struggled with it for about 2.5 years prior to that. My husband had achieved sobriety, and he came out of sobriety with severe memory loss. And I was noticing these gaps in his memory. And it started with just little things, the nuances of day-to-day life, of parenting, of work, of a word here and there, or my honey-do list, as I like to call it, for things to do around the house. And it just got worse. And I noticed over time, I thought initially, wow, this must be the residual from the alcohol. And I attributed everything to the alcohol. And so I probably let a good year go by before I said, no, I think we should see a neurologist. And then I was assuming that it was something that they term as wet brain. But the neurologist assured me that it couldn't be that, because my husband drank for several years and he mostly drank beer, and it wasn't coming from a huge consumption of hard alcohol. So a battery of tests were run, and they did supposedly do initial testing for dementia. And he did see a psychologist or psychiatrist, I'm not sure which, that specialized with this particular neurologist and worked in tandem. But I was not given the report to read myself. I was given his abridged version verbally of what was found. And the suggestion was made that in this age group that he was in, it's very common for men specifically to have cognitive and light to moderate memory loss if they went undiagnosed and untreated for ADHD as a child in this particular age group.
So he would have been like 47 and a half?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. We thought we had really done such great things as a family to get him to achieve sobriety. We uncovered that there was a long history on his father's side, generation after generation, of alcoholism, and that it was buried pretty deep down in the family stuff. Mm-hmm. And his mother was alive then, and she was so proud of him, and he really conquered this. And I have my best friend from college who was in a related field, and she was the one that helped me set everything up. After he had achieved a year of sobriety, she looked at me and she said, you know, like, this is unheard of. It's like a medical miracle. Nobody goes in and does this once and just walks out and goes, okay, I got this. But he did the steps, he did the work, and then he couldn't get through doing the steps. In other words, he went to all the meetings, but he was having difficulties digesting the material and working the program. And I noticed that he was having troubles with his thoughts and sorting through them. And then, as I said, the memory issues were prevalent and became more prevalent. And then little by little, I noticed things with his parenting, cognitive, just decisions, the way he would express something, his explanation to the kids, the way he would reprimand. And it just wasn't making a lot of sense. And so at this point, when we engaged with this neurologist, we were with him for a couple of years. And he did run a battery of tests. He saw him on a regular basis and at one point had determined, let's medicate for this ADHD now and see if it doesn't help. Well, when you medicate for ADHD, it's generally Ritalin or something that somebody who is obviously an alcoholic, an addict, should not be on. So he said there were some expensive alternatives, which of course the insurance company wouldn't accept. And I want to say that we must have been fiddling around with this for a good year plus, trying different dosages, trying a couple of different medications, and nothing was working. And when I really saw the cognitive decline, and I saw that he was really having troubles functioning with his thought process and reasoning, I went back to him and I said, look, you need to pursue and look again at Alzheimer's, at dementia, at something, and see if there's something there, despite his age. And I said, and if you don't, then you get to take him home for 2 weeks, because I can't live this way. We can't live this way. And he shouldn't have to. So he said, okay, well, it's really going to be hard to get a PET scan approved.
Because he's so young.
Yeah, the file's there that shows how long you've been treating him and there's not been any improvement. So it's a mystery. The brain's a mystery. This has to be a part of figuring it out. So we did the PET scan just before his 50th birthday and the results came back. And this doctor was incredibly apologetic. But what I have found is I have met other folks like us along the way in this specific age group. They've been misdiagnosed with a whole host of things, sleep apnea, split personality, just an array, and treated. I think also you lose time and you lose the ability to slow the disease down with the drugs that are out there. But we lost time as a family.
You're describing a huge problem out there.
It's a mystery, right? Is it environmental? Is there something that is now being discovered that's genetic? Is there misdiagnosis that's been going on for decades? So this particular physician said, look, I really can't treat him because this isn't my field of expertise and you need to get to somebody who can. And I said, really? How do I do that? And he suggested UCLA and that he knew somebody who was the head over there that ran a great program for a young onset. And then he went and looked the guy up and he was gone. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, there's somebody else there now, but I don't know him, but here's his name and maybe you can reach out. And that was it. We were sent off on our own.
I didn't think it was the alcohol-related dementia? Korsakoff's? No.
I mean, sure. Could there be a correlation? Could it have brought it out? Could it have fostered a younger onset? Maybe. But I also think that the other issue here is when you get that diagnosis, where do you go from there? Because you aren't in your 70s and it isn't the norm and nobody really knows what to do with you, square peg, round hole.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, at that point, what I did was I scoured the internet on the doctor they had given me at UCLA and tried to figure out any way I could get to him because calling UCLA was calling a general main line and having to go through a series of steps, and I wasn't going to wait. So I appealed to one of his nurses who was listed, and I was able to get her email address somehow in some article or something that was online, and I wrote her a passionate note. And I heard back almost immediately, and she asked me some other information, and I sent over some things that I had gotten from our doctor, and she said he wants to see you immediately. So I want to say from the time that he was diagnosed to the time we were in there was less than a month.
Oh, wow. They moved.
And he was in shock at how I got to him so quickly. But I can tell you that our first meeting with the doctor at the onset of him being treated for young onset, the doctor didn't realize that we hadn't had any time to digest what this disease meant or what the factors were for somebody that was younger or even what the conclusion was because neither of us had experienced Alzheimer's in our family or dementia in our family. So he rolled on into the office and patted my husband affectionately on the knee and said, "Dude, I'm so sorry. This is a death sentence."
Wow.
And that's how we learned what the outcome would be.
Oh, my goodness. And your daughters at the time, how old are they?
Good gosh. Okay, so I would say they were 11 and 14.
Wow. Could you believe this was happening?
No, I mean, it was hard enough to get them through the family counseling process for sobriety and to have my then 9-10-year-old be awakened to sitting through these group sessions on the weekends and listening to horror stories of young people in their 20s and their addictions, let alone fast forward to what this was. So we were very honest about what it was. I was unsure of which one of my kids would Google and start the process of wanting to know. And I kind of let it at that. I said, there's a lot of work ahead. This is not something that has a cure. Dad's going to decline over time. But I didn't state what we knew, which was, and it will end.
Oh, goodness. So, okay. So that was 7.5 years ago. Was he working at the time that he, what was his line of work?
He was in retail management his whole career. And we met at that company and he had dropped down to what would be considered a almost full-time status, but was no longer managing the retail store. So a lot of this was root memory, which is how he got away with the gaps in his memory for so long, because he could go through the motions. He had done this change in the work environment when we had returned from an out-of-state job that I had taken for a couple of years. And he couldn't necessarily get back to where he was in his managerial level. But we realized that he could do something that would bring in money, help our household, and allow him to start extremely early, like 5 a.m. in the morning, be off by midday to early afternoon, and be with our kids. And so he was the true caregiver to my kids in the afternoon until I got home in the evenings.
And he was able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it changed when we got the diagnosis. One of the things that, of course, I didn't know about was that he should have had his license, his driver's license, revoked immediately. And the doctor that we had originally seen didn't file the paperwork. And the doctor that we transferred to didn't realize that the paperwork hadn't been filed. And it wasn't until we were put into a dementia care group that provided us with a nurse practitioner who's basically almost like a social worker to us and is a liaison for all of my questions and who we meet with regularly. And we got in with a general practitioner that is a geriatric general practitioner, which I think is a really important thing to note, because having all of those medical people work in tandem with one another really does protect the patient from being wrongfully medicated, and like just how things are handled at a hospital level and the care that's given with other physicians. It's really important to be mindful of what some of the side effects can be long-term or short-term.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one medication list that everyone is looking at. You're in a comprehensive system, which is great.
It was that nurse practitioner that kind of woke up and realized, oh, hey, wait a minute. He's still driving. Mm-hmm. This can't happen. And I'm sorry to do this to you, but I have to make sure that the doctor files this paperwork. And my husband was still very alert, very aware of everything that was going on. And he was newly processing the disease. And this was one of the big things that I feel was going to emasculate him and really just have him go into sort of a tailspin about everything. And it did. And so we met with a special office for the DMV and had a series of one-on-one meetings. And then he would go and take the driver's test that he couldn't pass, because getting through that test was an impossibility at that point, and even at an early stage. So once he lost the ability to drive, it was then quite important for us to get my oldest daughter driving as soon as possible. We managed, we made do. We had friends, we had carpools, we worked it out. But he was largely sequestered to the home, working on things around the home for quite some time. And that was difficult.
So he had to give up his job.
Yeah.
His 5 a.m. job. Yeah. Would you say your daughters grew up more quickly?
Oh, no question. No question. And I would say my oldest daughter did, for sure. She really I don't want to say embraced it, but she took this on, and she had a very level head, and she was very much a caregiver, but also another parent in the house. So her younger sister has always looked up to her and always relied upon her for these types of things, and she's the go-to. And I did travel quite a bit for work up until the pandemic. And my daughter, my oldest daughter, was the one who put the dinner on the table and got the family organized and took care of her dad around the house and the day to day. So I give her all the credit in the world for backing me up when I would be out of town. And I tried to be as organized as possible. And I pre-cooked meals and tried to have everything listed and tried to make it as easy as possible. But yeah, I think they gave up a piece of their childhood for sure.
Yeah, I would imagine. Oh my goodness. So by now, let's say your husband is, how old would you say? How long ago was this?
So he was diagnosed just as he was turning 50. So it's been 6 years.
And he gave up his job. So where are we in his, was that just a couple of years ago that he was he able to work?
No, he actually lost his job. And I think this was a big part of it. There were some red flags. He had great reviews, but there was some politics going on. There were some other things going on. And I think this was a great excuse to get rid of somebody who had longevity at a company, who had the top pay for what they were doing, but who was fumbling a bit. And people were probably not understanding that. And he goes back to visit now. And certainly they understand because I have to tell them, hey, this is what happened. But yeah, so he's definitely been not working and out of a career for over 6 years.
Oh, over 6 years. So a lot happened. He lost his driver's license. He lost his job and now is home. Wow, that's a lot. And he's barely 50 years old.
Correct. And his way to deal with it would be he would go for extremely long walks during the day. And he would just walk for miles and miles and he would cry and he would sort of let it all out. And then he would come home and he would be sort of at peace, quiet, subdued. But he was still the guy that we knew and loved. And when the kids were around and when the family interacted, there was still a lot of fun and a lot of laughter and a lot of silliness.
Yeah, actually, we didn't even talk about. So like, describe who he had been. What kind of guy was he?
Well, for sure, when he was drinking, he was the life of the party. But then the party ended and he still was the life of the party. I mean, my husband volunteered at the kids' grade school for years and was their mascot. And would literally be called upon for every event you could possibly imagine to dress up in a very hot beaver outfit and be silly and be with the kids and entertain. And he loved it. And that was just one of many things. When you put him in a room and as soon as he developed a sense of, hey, I'm comfortable with these people, he let loose and he was funny and animated and he talked with funny accents and voices and he always wished he had done voiceover and probably he should have been on stage. He was that kind of guy. And he still is to some degree. He still is.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we have a funk or when we have a mood swing or we see him plummeting down into what is potentially going to be a psychotic episode and moment, it's pretty scary. But we have learned this past year to turn on the music and turn up the volume. Sometimes he dances it out. Sometimes he sings. Sometimes he wants to dance with you. Sometimes he just kind of flits about and moves, but it gets him to forget where he was going and it gets him to start on another path. And it's really, I'm in awe of it, of the power of music.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. So here we are. Take us a little bit like into the past 5 years. What would you say, like his memory?
I wish that I had documented and kept a journal, but I think that doing everything I do in the course of a day, I was so overwhelmed that I really didn't stop to think I should note some of these things down. I would tell you that we even did something with a physician out there of alternative medicine for the first couple of years with like almost an energy rebalancing. And I know it sounds very woo-woo, but a diet where every 6 weeks we went and he had a series of tests done. And he had a diet that was regurgitated out of a computer system that talked about restrictions. And it was really all around inflammation and blocking the inflammation so that it would slow down the rate of the disease or potentially reverse the damages, which of course didn't happen.
you were reaching for anything you thought could help.
Right. And of course, insurance didn't cover it. It was all out of pocket. And the one thing we were told going into this was the sad factor in young onset is it tends to have a much more rapid progression, mm-hmm. which one wouldn't think because you have a healthier person, but it ravages the brain. And so the thought for me was to do anything and everything. And as I look back, I think it did slow it down, and it was copious amounts of nutraceuticals and supplements. I had these crazy pill packets that I did for 3 times throughout the day of the things he was doing, tinctures and just everything you can imagine. And then these dietary restrictions that the one concern that his GP and nurse practitioner had were, don't let him lose any more weight. But he was strong and fit and agile. And so they kind of just let it go. And I was really quiet about it at first and didn't let them in that I was doing this because I was fearful that we would be blocked from participating in anything that might come along that he could perhaps be a part of in a medical trial. So I was really quiet about it. And then I want to say about 3 years into this, I just stopped because I realized that the train was leaving the station and it was starting to move pretty fast and there was nothing I could do and this money needed to be used elsewhere. And so I just departed from that particular treatment. And mindful, though, of keeping him on a lot of what I learned, which is a lot of the supplements that help with the inflammation. And a lot of the good oils and the good fats and blending things into smoothies and large amounts of organic greens and things like that. So he has a very balanced diet and he eats quite a bit. But his memory continued to escape. And I think the most alarming thing was at the time in the beginning, we were participating in a study for young onset. And the testing that they do is rigorous in terms of what they ask a ALS patient to answer or draw or recount. And it made him angry because in his mind, albeit quite childlike in the reaction, he just worried so much that he couldn't pass the test. Mm. And we had to sort of fortify the fact that this isn't a pass or fail. All of this is a marker to let us know how best to help you and where you're at. But he couldn't get past it because he just knew that he was failing the test. And so those were the hardest moments to watch and definitely a sense of frustration. But it was also the times where I recognized the loss of his ability to speak, words that were slipping away, the lack of expression. And there was even a period where I noticed that he just didn't have a lot of compassion or empathy. And again, that's the part of the brain that gets affected. So you see this person who is so loving and who is so charismatic and who would give anything to somebody in need. And suddenly I'd have like the flu or a sinus infection and he'd be annoyed. I thought, good God, give me a break. But then I realized, no, this is part of it. It's the sort of separation of thought and emotion.
Interesting. Wow. And that had never been like him.
No, he was always a guy that was super compassionate and he just lived life with his heart on his sleeve.
So sweet. How many years have you been married?
We will be married in September 25 and we were together for 5 prior. So yeah, long time.
Mm. And you're young yourself. I mean,
55. Yeah.
Wow. So you guys are about the same age.
Yeah. So we started this journey together in our 20s, and I can tell you that I never thought this would be a possibility, nor did I really know that it existed, to be honest.
Sure. How would you ever know? Who would ever think this would be going on?
I mean, I will say that my husband was never a great multitask. It was sort of one thought at a time, and I used to joke when I needed him to focus on things, and I'd snap my fingers and say, ADD boy, over here. And then, of course, when he was misdiagnosed with ADHD, I was like, ah, shoot, I guess I have to stop joking about that. And then we used to make these comments like, are you having an ALS moment? Like, you're having a senior moment.
Right.
I can't do that either because it's just, oh my God, you feel so horrible. That leads me to, as a caregiver, whether it's this age group or any, you lose your patience. I mean, I call it dropping my basket. And I do find myself yelling sometimes. Oh, I mean, there was a period of time a couple years in where I was yelling all the time. And I really had to get myself in check. And then I caught myself one day and I turned around and I looked at him and he was so fearful. And all he wanted to do was please. And I said to him, I want you to know that every single time I yell, I'm yelling at the disease. I'm mad at the disease. I'm never mad at you. And I find that I do that every time now that I lose my patience. I have to remind myself to remind him and grab him by the shoulders and have him look at me and just say it till I think it sinks in somewhere in his soul. And it helps.
Absolutely. I'm sure it helps you and it helps him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's true. You are mad at the disease.
No question.
Yeah. It's so unfair. How is he today? Tell us how things are.
So the pandemic put us all in a home together for quite a long time, but it also removed him from some of his routines of being social, of getting out. And he went everywhere with me in terms of social visits. And so not having anybody but us for what? A year, year and a half until we got a little break and then got sort of put back into our boxes again. I think that that really escalated a decline as well. He would sit on the couch in my office, he still does, and watch me work. The kids would be on their Zoom classes. And in the midst of all of this, which I haven't even mentioned, Barbara, my daughter, my older daughter, was graduating high school a few years back. She was 17 and she was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Oh my gosh.
And that tore apart our routine at home. And that was the beginning of the end of Eric being able to be somewhat self-reliant with heating up something in the microwave, doing some dishes, putting some laundry in. And so that's when my younger daughter really was sequestered at home that summer while I was back and forth staying in the hospital, because we stayed in the hospital for a lot of the treatments, for about half of them. And then there were infection upon infection and reasons that we had to go back in. And I had given my daughter a promise when she was diagnosed that I would never leave her alone overnight in the hospital. And I was true to my word, but it took a village. I had friends that really dropped off things weekly and looked in on my husband and took him out and drove him out to us. And my company that I work for was amazing. And they said, we're going to send a car once or twice a week to bring him out.
Wow.
And he would just spend the day with us. And I know now that Keaton, my oldest daughter, was like, I've had it up to here with you guys. I've seen too much of you. Appreciative and never complained, but definitely we were up in her space while she was going through treatment. And I'm happy to say that she's now over 2 years cancer-free.
Oh, thank God.
And she is on the road in her path as a young adult. But that took a lot out of my husband because there was an interruption in the routine. And I think there was a tremendous amount of emotion that he couldn't express, but that was stuck inside there. Mm-hmm. The moments that he knew what was going on, and then there were moments that he didn't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he watched her lose her hair. He watched her lose her eyelashes. He watched all of that. But it wasn't necessarily going to make sense as to what was going on.
So everything ends up falling on you.
Yeah. But, we're a team, we're a family, and we help each other.
Right.
It put a lot of pressure on my youngest. She probably had the worst summer of her life. There was a shift in a dynamic in friendships as a result of it, because those that she thought were her friends really abandoned her. So she started over the next year, which was fine. She's better for it. She has a great group of friends. She joined B'nai B'rith youth group. She then became a board member and held board positions. It's helped her get into college. It's helped her mature. It's helped with her reasoning. And it's helped her be a better caregiver. I can tell you, whether they're 11 and 14 or 17 and 20, the difference in these two children for me is I have one that will just be damned with the world if you don't like what you see or are uncomfortable by it. And she will openly express what's going on to anyone. And she doesn't apologize. And then I have my younger daughter who really is embarrassed to a certain degree or doesn't feel she needs to share it and then doesn't bring people around. So she spends a lot more time isolated. But her friends have come around and they've told her, we're here for you.
What a story. Wow. Yeah. Just when you think like you've had the worst news, then your daughter's news.
Yeah. But the philosophy we had, first of all, incredible care. So a shout out to City of Hope, amazing people. She went in with the, I think, strongest fortitude one could ever hope for and have. And I think we both did. And her philosophy from the day she got the diagnosis of her cancer was not if, but when I will be done and I will be cured. I can't say that about Alzheimer's, right? We're not there yet. But that fortitude applies to the caregiving. And sometimes we have to live day to day, because if we look too far forward, it's too fearful for us. It's just, it's scary. And we'd probably crash. We'd probably fall down hard. But I think that if you give the most in every day that you possibly can, and you have support one way or another, you find support and people to talk to, you get through it.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. I absolutely agree with you about just being where your feet are, taking it one day at a time. So talk about the support that you've had, because I do know that you've been going to a support group, and tell us how that's played out for you.
So our nurse practitioner turned us on to a support group, turned me on to a support group very early on in us joining with them. So I'll say this, Eric was diagnosed. We got to the young onset specialist, but it took over a year to get us into the geriatric dementia program that has then allowed him to have and us to have the tentacles with the nurse practitioner and the GP and the network and the system that we're in. And so another year had gone by and the nurse practitioner had said, I really think you should try this support group. And so I did. And here's a problem. Young onset has a pretty big span in age, and not a lot of people that I was finding at the time that were my age group. What I was working with were people that were lovely and had been in a group together for a long time and had been on a journey together for a long time. They had kids that were growing and out of the house, and it was a very different scenario, and many of them were able to retire or had retired. That's not the case here. So I struggled just to get to the monthly meeting, because inevitably I would have it on my calendar and then work would say, you have to be here, you have to be there. So I'd be on my phone in a parking lot somewhere, or I might be in an airport or across the country. And I just wasn't ready for it. And I think I wasn't ready for it because I wasn't finding a synergy that I could apply. And my husband wasn't as advanced. When the pandemic started and I started to see more of a decline, that's when I went back. I had stopped going for a number of years. And then I just popped back in. And it happened at that point that there were a couple people that were in my age group with younger kids that were going through the same thing I was going through, albeit a different type of dementia for their husbands. But we rallied and we brought a new dimension to our support group. But we were able to lean on those that have been there before us and experience their wisdom and their knowledge of, here's what you do. Here's who to talk to. No, don't do this, do that. Have you asked about this medication? I mean, we're really a great functioning group, and it's at a high level where we have the greatest amount of respect for one another, but we're there for each other. So there was a bit of a spinoff in that the younger three of us with the younger kids were able to really kind of spin off and have separate conversations and get a therapist for our kids, because one of them found a therapist and was using the therapist. And the other one told me about the therapist. And this is a guy who he had had a parent that he lost from young onset. And so I put my kids in touch with him. And for the first time, they came back and said, yeah, thumbs up. We like him. Wow. And they don't see him on a regular basis. And it's probably time now for a check-in, but they know he's there. And I think that knowing that was a really important step. And then sometime last summer, or last spring really, we got a notification sent to us, three women who have kids that are still at home and younger. And it was about a group that was starting, or I should say it was a new nonprofit out of Chicago. And I want to give a shout out to them because Diana Coes is the woman who started it, and it's called Lorenzo's House. And her husband is a similar age to mine. And she gave up, I believe, a 35-year career in education and started this nonprofit and has done wonders in just a year. And as she got it off the ground, her son, who is similar ages to my kids, both her kids are, one of her kids came back to her and said, "What about something for the kids?" And it resonated with her, and she leapt forward, and he reached out, and she was able to get the attention of Seth Rogen and his wife and the charity that they have. And they helped fund and get off the ground a one-day virtual summer camp for kids of parents with dementia. And that was a game changer for all of us. Because for me, in just vetting out the camp, I met a whole host of people across the country going through this. And we started saying, well, what about us? We want to talk to each other. We want to support each other. And we started and formed another group very loosely. And we're still getting it off the ground. There are more people coming every month to do this. And then the kids really enjoyed the camp and they found it useful. My kids wanted to see more kids their age, but they knew that in time they would build it and they would come. And so they got together with Diana, the founder, and her son. And we all put our heads together and they started something called the Light Club. And now the Light Club is spinning off into three different clubs. One for younger children that are basically like primary school aged, one for teens, and one for young adults. Mm-hmm. And that actually kicks off tonight. Wow. Where they are hosting these other kids and they're coming together and they're building it and they're deciding how they want this to form and shape. And their initial thought was, we want to be able to talk about serious stuff, but we want to have some fun. We want to forget our troubles. We want to leave them at the door sometimes, but we want to support each other. And when you have
light, like L-I-G-H-T, light, like
correct.
Let's leave our troubles behind for
yes.
this time. Just that's great. Uh-huh.
And when you have a span of age groups, the way this one did, the recognition from the older kids was we want to be able to say things and not scare the other kids. And so as we started getting more people, and might I say more women, because a majority of the adults that I'm interacting with are women. There have been a couple of men who have come through with their kids, but none that have wanted to join us in this particular adventure of what we're trying to put together. And so we have a brunch group now once a month in three time zones, and we put it together. Whoever wants to join and can join does, and it goes on usually for a good, I'd say hour, hour and a half, and then some of us linger on and continue to talk. It's generally earlier for me, so I don't have to rush anywhere. My household is usually still sleeping, and it's great. It's a wonderful way to help each other, and we're working on information boards that we can post things on. I need help with this. Can you give me resources for that? Or it could be something as trivial, although not trivial, but silly, as what brand pull-ups do you use for your loved one? How do you deal with bedwetting at night? Bowel impaction. I mean, all the things that come with this disease that I never knew I would need to know the term for, let alone the cure for. And how to get through these things and how to stumble into a more peaceful existence. We talk about our kids. We talk about, oh, somebody's got a sassy teenager who thinks they know it all. I want them to join this group, but they won't. We talk about a whole host of things, but it's easier for me, and I would imagine easier for them, to bring these things out and to dial them into your head of, this is my list of things I want to go over this week with these people, whether it be my California group or whether it be my group centered out of the Midwest. It's easier than going to my friends. I will share with some of my closest friends a lot of this, but there's a lot that I don't, because I'm not going to drag them through it. And I think they would be there for me, but it's just a lot to ask. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's a frustration on my part, because a lot of times the answers are vague, or they want to be helpful, but they don't know how. And I'm not one to really like to ask for help. So I have to learn to be better at that. And being in these groups, you're held accountable for that. You're held accountable when you talk about the things you're going through and what you're putting on yourself as a caregiver and as a parent and as a wife and a mother and as a woman, or just a human being that puts all this on them. Mm. And these people stop and say, hey, wait a minute. You can't do that. That's too much. Or you shouldn't ask yourself to do that. You should do this, this, and this. Or have you thought of this? And it really makes a difference. It resonates because there is a mutual understanding. And you think, okay, that's sound advice. Mm-hmm. So you're willing to take it and try it.
You are amazing. Oh my gosh. The fact that you have just turned this situation into a way to advocate and help others and form this group. That's amazing.
Well, my husband asked for it as well when he could. So when we started the program at UCLA, they started a caregiver day that was basically an educational forum for caregivers and a little bit of counseling and resources. And on that initial one that they started, and I'm going to count back now and say it had to be 5 years ago, I got a call last minute before attending, and somebody had heard our story, and our nurse practitioner said, oh, I think you should talk to this woman. She's really open about things, and I think she would be great to talk to. So I got a very vague phone call asking me to be interviewed, and it was for some sort of a news broadcast. Nobody was specific at the time until I was vetted out further and told that it was actually for Jane Pauley's show, which is the Sunday morning show. Now, as far as I know, that interview never came to light. It was a collection that they were doing of caregiver interviews that she's very impassioned by. But it just hasn't, nothing's happened that I know of. And I needed to ask my husband's permission to tell our story on camera. And then they wanted to come into our house and they wanted to interview the kids and they wanted to follow us around for a day and then come back for some follow-up interviews. And we did all of it. My kids had a difficult time and didn't want to be interviewed at the time, and they respected that. But my husband was great. And I asked him because he was able to really reason these things at that time. And I said, I won't do it if you don't want me to. If you want to be private about this, I will. But let me share with you why I want to do it. And he looked at me before I could say anything. And he said, if this can help one person out there who has been misdiagnosed and is living like this, then I want to do it.
So great. That's so great.
And so I think he gave me that strength and he gave me the will to want to be open about it. And I'm curious as it is as a person. And I guess my thought is that I don't have immediate family per se of my own. So you build an extended network, but through that you build knowledge, you share knowledge and you share love.
Yeah. I'm crying myself because I see that happen in our support groups. So in my support groups, so I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
These become family of choice and so important to you.
And selfishly, my thought was, wow, if more of our story gets out there and Diana at Lorenzo's house believes the same thing, more pours in, more resources, more people who want to conquer this disease. More people who want to commit and do something to create change.
Absolutely. To bring visibility to this group. Yes.
Yeah. But I will tell you that I have not myself personally interacted with the Alzheimer's Association. Mm-hmm. I found my way in through other associations and groups. And I know that they have a tremendous amount of resources and a tremendous amount to offer. But I have heard directly from some of the folks in my groups that there's a lack of understanding of the separation that's needed for the young onset. And that's been challenging.
Well, hopefully you will change that.
Maybe.
Yes, your mission. Certainly it will. Bring us up to date with how Eric is doing now.
A day in the life of, let me paint that for you. He has gone from having the occasional incontinence and wearing a pad to wearing a pull-up. And now he's gone from wearing a pull-up to wearing a pull-up with a pad on top of it. And whereas he used to think that he had to go to the bathroom and urinate constantly. He now doesn't seem to know when he has to. And that has sort of left his brain. So a lot of prompts and reminders are needed. A lot of clothing changes happen. He cannot shave himself. He probably about 4 or 5 months ago stopped being able to truly shower and bathe himself. So that's me with a sprayer and scrubbing him up and shaving him and brushing of the teeth. We had an electric toothbrush, thought that would be easier. That turned out to be something that ended up more on the ceiling than in his mouth. So we switched back to the good old fashioned kind. And he does a okay job, not a great job. I set a timer for 2 minutes and I usually extend it over. I encourage movement, turn it to this side, move the toothbrush, do this, do that. And I always end with an oral rinse. He went from having probably as a man who was healthy, the most scheduled bowel movements to ones that are great surprises at the most inopportune moments and end up in places that they should not. Or he gets very impacted, he was hospitalized actually in June because we had tried everything and he was going back and forth to UCLA and they were administering enemas and we were giving him copious amounts of things to relieve him and nothing was working. And he ended up going in the hospital overnight and having to be cleared out. And ever since then, he's remained on a daily dosage. So going back to the things that I give him that aren't prescribed, I add in things that I know will help. A little bit of prune juice, something at nighttime to move things along. And it's unfortunate because the way that the body works when you have dementia, that doesn't produce regularity. It produces movement, but all kinds of movement. Some days more so than you would ever want, and some days less. So discomfort, but he has a hard time expressing that there's discomfort. Usually we see a change in his eating habits, and that's how we know he's kind of backed up and it's time to force everything out. He wants to dress himself, but can't, and has kind of given up to the fact that he needs assistance, getting his arms through the armholes, getting the pant legs on correctly or the pants on the right direction. With a lot of encouragement, he puts the socks on. And with assistance, he now wears slip-on shoes. About a year ago, my daughters and I converted all of his athletic shoes to slip-ons with laces that were like magnetic so that they'd always be slip-ons. And then little by little, we just started getting rid of everything and going to Velcro or just slip-on. More recently, getting his arms in sleeves that are long-sleeved, like a jacket, is really challenging. He seems to want to continue to turn in circles when I'm doing that. So it's a source of frustration for both of us. And I have increased his dental visits now to every 3 months because I feel that that's the only way to ensure oral care. He sleeps soundly. I will say that. I hear all these stories. And for a while during the progression of the disease, he was talking full, coherent, complete sentences, laughter. I don't know where these conversations came from. I assume they were in the recesses of his memory and they were things that he was reaccounting for, but then he would wake up in the morning and not be able to form his words clearly. Now I don't hear him dream as much out loud. And now, as in this week, what I am experiencing is, for whatever reason, he is urinating at night to the point where it is soaking through his pull-up, the pads, his clothes. So now I'm getting him up twice throughout the night to try and stop that and looking for new resources on what to do next. Yeah. and how to get through this part of it.
And do you have any help at home?
No. He goes to daycare twice a week. Mm-hmm. That was intended to be 3 days a week for full days. And the other 2 days I would work out between my oldest daughter and myself. My work schedule, because of the pandemic, continued to be delayed in the return to work. And now my permanent return to work will be in March for 2 days a week in the office, 3 days a week, either on the road or at home. And I am going to have to look at more care. I am hoping that initially what will happen is the state of California will start opening up the senior care centers more. And the one that we're at that we positively love and don't want to leave, and he has great relationships there, and it's just worked out so well, will be a full-day program, and will allow him to go 3 full days. It's very stimulating. he was a little, he had fun at first, but then he would complain on the way. And when I tried to put it into words, he said, yes, that exactly. And it was the age difference, right? The mobility of the others versus his mobility. But now he embraces it and he dances and he brings joy to the people there and he knows it. And so he's super animated and he is fulfilled by that.
That's so great.
I recently learned in visiting with the doctor, she pointed to a screen to be respectful of what he was understanding at the moment and said, have you seen this chart? And I said, no. And she said, well, this is where you're at. And it was indicating the age level he's at about now, which is right around 4. Mm. And that probably was generous.
Does he recognize you?
No, he does not recognize me as his wife. He claims he's not married. Sometimes he says, yeah, he's married, but he can't go on specifically about it. Most of the time he just shrugs and says, no, he's not. My oldest daughter likes to quiz him regularly just because she thinks it's helpful. Sometimes I stop her because I think that it's maybe irritating and perhaps a trigger for him. Mm-hmm. But most of the time he's really just in it to sort of banter back and forth. Sometimes you ask him if he has children and he says no. And then sometimes he goes, well, wait, yes, I have 7. And then he starts laughing. Mm-hmm. So now you don't know, is he kidding or is he serious?
Right.
So she usually goes to the gamut of, I'm one of your kids. She says her name and her age. And she says who his other child is, name and age. And then she goes back to me. This past, I want to say Christmas, maybe just before, he all of a sudden looked at me and he said he really liked me a lot. In fact, he loved me and he wanted to know if I'd be his girlfriend. I laughed and I looked across and I said, your girlfriend. And he said, well, I mean, would you marry me? And I said, you probably don't remember this, but you asked me to marry you before. And I was so quick to say yes. You're kind of a handful. I don't know if I'm going to say yes so fast this time. I got to think about it. And everybody got a kick out of it. Mm-hmm. And he was so sweet. Yeah. Most days, he is so familiar and dependent upon me. Mm-hmm. Not sure of who I am to him, but he knows we're deeply connected. And he loves me. And he expresses love.
Clearly, he's still
kisses,
attracted to you.
I get hand-holding. Yeah. But yeah, there's not an association with what that relationship means. Mm-hmm. And not an association usually with the fact that his children are his children and what that relationship means. So very toddler-like in like kind of in awe of trying to figure it all out, but then it's gone the next moment.
It sounds like you guys have taken this in stride, like maybe the initial sting of it all. I think it would be hard for you and your kids to not be recognized, at least initially.
I think the sting of it for them was big. Right. Yeah. I think I expected it. I knew it was coming. And it was actually one of the first things I got very annoyed at our neurologist when we transferred over to the young onset. And I asked a myriad of questions as I always do. And I had a whole list and I went through them and I got, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And I got pissed. Mm-hmm. And I said, you don't know a lot and you're supposed to be the expert here. Is there any one thing you can tell me? I said, how about this? Can you tell me when my husband is going to wake up and not know who I am or who his children are? He goes, oh, yeah, that's easy. I said, really? How is that easy? He said, for some reason, we do hold that data. And that data that's generated tells us that 7 years into the disease. And I looked at him and I said, so when would that be? What do I count as the start of the disease? And at that time, he looked at me and he said, I'd say he's at probably around the 2.5 year mark. Maybe 3. So I think we got more time out of it. And he was wrong, I'm happy to say. Maybe not entirely wrong, but wrong-ish. I guess maybe what he could have said was, he won't know you as his wife. And he won't know your name. He won't know your children's names or their ages or who they are to him. But he'll know you in his heart and his soul.
Right, exactly. Like on a cellular level, he knows you.
Yeah. So I think that's the thing that we embrace that takes the sting away. And honestly, we've been living with this for so long that so much of the sting has been taken away. But to his credit, he is the one who led with laughter and a sense of humor from the get-go. Mm. So in the early part of this, when you might say or ask him to do something, he would look and he would sort of, with a half-cocked smile, say, I have Alzheimer's. And then it would get us all laughing. Nice try. That's not an excuse. You still have to do this. Mm-hmm. You still have to fold the laundry. You still have to, whatever the chore was. And so we continue to brighten his day and our day with humor. And you have to have a sense of humor. And sometimes I have to tell you, it's a shock value for people who are not familiar with it with us, because we can go to places where some people would think, well, that's just uncool. But, you know, you just have to.
Oh, absolutely. Gets you through your day.
Yeah.
Of course. Laughter, best medicine. One of the other people I talked to said, the soul does not get dementia.
No.
No.
It doesn't, which is what makes it so difficult when the masking of the emotions and the emoting occurs, where that sense of empathy ebbs and flows, and sometimes you just can't see it. That probably was the hardest thing for me, where there were moments in time when my daughter was going through cancer treatment, and we had some horrific experiences that literally scared the crap out of me, and he was just stoic through it all, kind of clueless. And I had to remind myself, he's just not there right now. Right. And maybe that's his shield.
That's true. Yeah. Maybe that was a protective
mechanism. Maybe that's one thing the disease does for them, is give them a shield to cope for things that in this particular circumstance with this disease would be very hard to do.
Absolutely. That's a good way of looking at it.
And I will say this, we have a family mascot. We do have a couple of dogs in this household, but one in particular that is near and dear to my husband. He's 20 years old, and he's a little Chihuahua West Highland White Terrier mix. His name is Furby, and he also has Alzheimer's and wears a diaper.
Yes. Your husband is not alone.
He is not, and he knows it, and he carries him around constantly, and he talks to him. And somehow they communicate on a level that none of us can understand, but there is a true bond there.
Good. Glad to hear it. You've talked about a lot of things over the course of the last 7 years. Any other challenges that stick out in your mind?
What I guess I didn't realize was how much slower he would get. And I'm not talking about the brain, movements. I know that we would go in for checkups, and I know that the doctor would have him do squats and test all kinds of things that a geriatric doctor does test. And then she would laugh and say, all right, Eric, you're fine. You can stop doing those now. And more recently, watching his balance, or he has what the doctor has termed a startle effect. So it's the startling effect that infants and newborns get, right? Of just a nerve reaction in their body where there's a jolt. And he gets them now. And he sometimes is literally thrown off of his feet. And there's no explanation for it, except to say that it's the nerves in his body reacting to the disease. And he has a lot of trembling. Those are the really challenging things, because you still have somebody who's mobile. And I remember a lot of warnings with somebody saying, well, if you're going to make a move, move now, because they're not going to be able to handle it later. It's harder for them. Or you should move down from the second floor to the first floor. I thought, why would I do that? I mean, he still gets up and down the stairs perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. But one day he won't. We had a frightening episode one night. That was a thing I didn't even know how to describe to the doctor. And it was the middle of the night. He simply couldn't bend his knees. Mm. I have him sit down to urinate now. And that's a challenge in and of itself, because it's root memory that he wants to stand. So I'm the one that has to turn around and sit him down, or whoever's helping him. And on this particular occasion, he was standing and could not sit. And he was so out of it. I mean, he was definitely having some sort of an episode. And trying to explain this to the doctor, I mean, it was just so difficult to put into words of what I saw. And I was frightened, like, is this the new normal? No, it went away. He moves at a glacial pace. And that is super frustrating, because going for a walk, I know he can walk several miles and wants to. But do we have to do it at such a slow pace? I guess we do.
To get anywhere on time, I'm sure.
Absolutely. You think you've budgeted enough time in the morning to get him dressed and out the door, but there are mornings that just doesn't work out that way. Planning ahead, making plans for the next stage, for the final stage, finding my time and energy to put into really doing all of that. I have one friend in my group here in LA who threw herself into that. And that was how she coped. And that's what she did. It's the other stuff, the more emotional, that is harder for her. I'm quite surprised at myself because I do not like to cry in front of people. And I do not like to get too emotional in front of people unless I feel super comfortable to do so. And I don't allow myself to do it. And this has opened me up a lot more, kind of like a pressure cooker, I'm sure. But I also think that for me, for my failings or where I feel I've misstepped is when I had that time, when I had that freedom that I wasn't so tethered to him, I should have done all of the legal and the financial and all of those things. And we can all say woulda, coulda, shoulda. In the end, it's going to get done and it's going to happen one way or another. And those are all things that I'm working on now at my own glacial pace, by the way. But and just because I'm overwhelmed by it, of where to find the time in the day and the night. Mm-hmm. But that's a scary part of it. And depending on your personality and depending on where you are in your life and the type of personality and person you are, I usually am a very organized person. And I am very much so in certain facets of my life. This is one that I just, for whatever reason, have been dragging my feet on. And I've never been comfortable with death. I've never found a place in my heart, my head, and my soul to feel like I can accept it. And I've experienced a lot of loss. And this is yet another one that I will experience. And I think that probably it's me pushing it off and saying, not today, tomorrow. So that's probably, if anybody's listening, what I would say is make somebody hold you accountable for getting at least half of the things done that are on the to-do list for the finances and for the planning ahead of what happens. I have a mental
documents you
made. Yeah. Yeah. And I have a mental picture of what I think is the right next step, but it could change at any time. I really thought that when he got to a place where there was a total disassociation with us, that the best thing for everybody would be to have him live outside the home. And for some people, their loved one who's inflicted with this is a flight risk, right? He is not at this point. Mm-hmm. I do have a safety lock on the front door that he cannot open. He does not associate the back door with a way out other than into the yard. And he does not associate the garage door with a way out other than into the garage. He doesn't press the button to open it. So clearly I'm at a different place than some other people that I communicate with and that share their thoughts with me and seeing what they've gone through. I mean, listen, it's hell for everybody, but I would just say that don't lose your temper with yourself and don't be too angry with the things you haven't done. Embrace the things you have and continue to motor on with the things you haven't and learn to ask for help.
Really good suggestions. Yeah, this is overwhelming. And it's okay for the things to stay on your to-do list for a while.
And I go back to what I said earlier, which was I wish I had written things down more and journaled. I am a writer. I did a blog because I couldn't stand the thought of answering the same thing over and over again when my daughter went through her chemo. And that journey was so raw. And it could have been somebody that I just was associated with in business, or it could have been my best friend. If they asked, I would let them link into this blog and read. And most of my friends would call each other crying and saying, don't read this while driving. You will never make it. It's just a place that I go and a style that I have. And my friends know me for it. And I wish that I could have started sooner with Lorenzo's house. I've written a few things and put it out there. And Diana has taken snippets and published them, whether it be in social media or use them for meetings, for fundraising, board meetings and such. I'll continue to write. As soon as the thought comes across, I try and write things down and then build them out later.
Good for you. It's not too late. It really and isn't.
I think maybe it'll be a part of my grief. I think that there is a grief for somebody who is dealing with this now. And it's a type of grief that is ongoing. And then I've seen from some of my friends in my groups that have lost their loved ones, how the grief shifts because you suddenly have all of that time back that you didn't have before. And that grief takes on a new meaning. And I hope that for me, it will be to write something.
I hope so too. You are so articulate. I can only imagine how great a writer you are. So that would be terrific. And I agree. There's so much grief involved, so much disappointment and expectations lost. And it's like living grief every day, I'm sure. Here you are. No one would expect this. No one would have imagined this. Not this early in your marriage and your lives. No. This is the unthinkable, the unimaginable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I feel like so many of us have hurdles that are unthinkable and unimaginable that we go through in life. And I don't want to sound trite and say it makes us stronger, but, you know, we survive them. And I guess they're building blocks to things that will happen next. And it's all a matter of what we choose to do with them.
Absolutely. It sounds like it made you guys closer. You as a family closer.
I believe it did. I really do. I mean, I always parented with a tremendous amount of openness and dialogue. But, and I never believed when my kids were little on talking down to them. I believed on talking straight. Mm-hmm. And of course, editing. But this has made it, I hope, with both my kids, so that they feel that they can tell me anything and that we can get through anything together.
And you have. Oh, gosh. I would love to have you back.
Absolutely. Just, I'm sure there's another chapter in this. So
yes, I would love to have you back. This is just, you're amazing. You really are.
Thank you.
Kimberly, you have been eye-opening. It's just a pleasure to talk to you this morning. I'm so sad with you and for you that this is going on in your life. And I applaud you for being out there, for being visible, for having the courage to tell your story, not just to me, but to Jane Pauley, to the media, to Seth Rogen and his wife, to start what you can when you see a void, really, to just be brave and move forward. And it's inspiring. It really is. You have an inspiring story. Sad, sad, sad. I mean, do you ever have a pity party with all of this going on?
You would think that with maybe my girlfriends that I have made in these groups and guy friends, or with my other girlfriends, that I would. And maybe it's just my nature and my character that I just don't go there. Probably the closest thing I get to a pity party is when there is that random large bowel movement that ends up on the floor while the cleaning lady is there, and I'm mortified and trying to clean it up and do everything I can to act normal. And all I can do is lose my mind and shout out, "Oh my God, this is my life. How did I get here?" That's kind of the extent of it for me. That's where I go.
That's where you go. Oh, you're amazing. Oh, if that's the only time you lose it, that's incredible.
Here's what I will say, and this is really where I'd like to leave it with everybody who is listening. If there is one thing that I strive for every day, and the credo of what we go through in this family, our motto is with grace and dignity. And that's not just for us. That's for Eric. Because large poops on the floor aside, everything that he goes through, everything that he must feel at some place in that shell that he's in, right? That's trapped inside. I know that there are moments where he's frustrated and moments where he's hurt and moments where he's angry and confused and sad and the gamut of emotions. And all I can hope for is that we help him live out each day with grace and dignity. So as a caregiver, for anybody who wants to know the best thing they could possibly do and the route to take, is the route that offers grace and dignity to your loved one till the end.
Beautifully said. Thank you for that.
Thank you for joining us today on another episode of Dementia Discussions. If you're a caregiver or know someone who's a caregiver that would like to be a guest on the show, please call me at 310-362-8232 or go to dementiadiscussions.net/contact and let me know. I would love to have you. Remember that you can follow Dementia Discussions on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and many more. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, it would mean a lot if you would leave me a review. For any other information about this podcast, please visit me at dementiadiscussions.net. And please share this podcast with someone you know if you think it may help. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you here again next time on Dementia Discussions.